Chapter 12, The Diary at 70. The hand did not tremble when I first took up the pen. Not so much that I remember it. Age had come into me by then, as it comes into every man if he is granted years enough, but it had not yet taken from me the use of my fingers or the habit of writing what should be preserved. I was in my 70th year. Iowa had become the country of my age, the old Wisconsin fields, the portage roads, the camps and bayous and rivers of the war, the long wagon journey into Iowa, the Clarksville years, the Charles City years, the children grown and scattered, the graves where we had stood, all these lay behind me, and yet were not behind me. They were gathered in the papers on the desk. There were the old war papers, rougher than my memory wanted them to be, and more faithful than memory alone could ever be. A soldier's diary is not written for ornament. It is written when the day allows. It is written with a tired hand, sometimes by poor light, sometimes with the body aching, sometimes while orders are expected, or disease is near, or the next march has already been spoken of. It does not wait for the mind to be settled. It catches what can be caught. The diary had done that work for me. It had held dates, miles, camps, rivers, towns, boats, railroads, marches, and the names of places I might otherwise have blurred together in the long accumulation of years. It had held the road from Wisconsin into the service, the Red River country, the labor at Bailey's Dam, the Gulf, the siege works before Spanish Fort, the charge at Fort Blakely, Mobile, and the slow closing of the war. It had held the evidence that a plain soldier had moved through history and had not only dreamed afterward that he had been there. The record says I rewrote the diary in my 70th year. That is true. It is a small sentence for a large labor. I did not sit down merely to copy words from one paper to another. I sat down to put order upon memory while there was still time. I had lived long enough to know that a thing not made plain may be lost even while it remains in a house. A paper may survive and still be unreadable. A name may be kept and still be misunderstood. A life may be remembered by those who knew it, and then by those who only heard of it, and then by no one. I did not know who would read the clean copy. I knew only that someone might. The first duty was to the page. I laid out the old papers and began where the war began for me. The young man who had written those first entries was not young by Army standards. I had enlisted at 32, already a husband, a father, a widower once, an immigrant, a farmer, and a Baptist man. Still, the writer in those pages was younger than the man holding them 40 years later. He did not know what he would survive. He did not know which names would remain sharp in him and which would fade. He did not know that he would come to 70 and read his own hand as if reading from another man. There is a strange feeling in meeting one's former self on paper. I could see where haste had pressed the letters. I could see where a place name had been put down as soon as it was learned, where a count of miles mattered because movement itself had become part of the service. The obituary would later record the total, 6,825 miles, 803 by rail, 5,210 by steamboat, 812 marching. I did not need the total to remember the miles, but I was glad the total was kept. A number can carry truth when feeling grows too large for speech. Railroad miles have their own sound and memory. Steamboat miles have another. foot miles have another. The rail shook a man among strangers and equipment. The boat carried him on brown water, sometimes with room enough to watch the shore, and sometimes with bodies crowded so close that privacy was impossible. The march gave every mile to the feet. A man remembers a march not as a line on a map, but as a soreness in the body, the weight of the gear, the dust or mud, the keeping up, the stopping, the starting again. I copied the miles because they were facts. I also copied them because facts are a mercy. They keep an old soldier from making his war larger or smaller than it was. I had no wish to dress mine in glory. I wished to leave it traceable. Looking back from the diary, Edward, bound at 70. When I rewrote the old diary, I understood that I was not simply preserving what had happened. I was confessing that the boy and the man, the soldier and the old father, the marcher and the Sunday school superintendent were one life under God. There were entries I could copy without pain. A date, a town, a camp, a distance, a river crossed, a boat taken, a march ordered. Such things came cleanly from the old page to the new. There was satisfaction in making them legible. The old hand had served its purpose in the field. The new hand served another purpose, not to endure rain and fatigue, but to endure time. Other entries slowed me. A name could do it. Peter LaFlower's name had not lost its power because years had passed. A battlefield does not remain always before the eye, but a dead man's name can. So can the thought of Janet at home with children, receiving such news as could reach her and wading through silences she did not choose. So can the memory of having written, "Whatever I am doing, I think of home," and knowing 40 years later that it was not a flourish, it was the truth of the service. Home accompanied me even where home could not help me. I had to decide what kind of cleanliness I meant by a clean copy. A clean hand is not the same as a clean memory. I could make the script regular. I could straighten a line. I could put a map where a map belonged and make the road easier for another eye to follow. But I could not make war tidy. I could not make fear pious by smoothing it. I could not make hunger, heat, sickness, confusion, bad command, or death into something more orderly than they had been. So I copied with a restraint I hoped was honest. I did not write myself into a hero because the papers would not bear it. I did not write myself out of the story because Providence had left me alive to keep it. I had been one private soldier in Company C, 23rd Wisconsin Volunteer Infantry. I had done the tasks assigned to me as well as I could. I had traveled the miles. I had seen men suffer. I had hoped to return. I had returned. There is a temptation in old age to make the past instructive too quickly. A man wants the young to understand, so he shapes the story toward a lesson. Lessons are good when they are true, but the record must come first. If the Lord meant my service to teach anything to those after me, it would not do so because I improved it. It would do so because I left the road as faithfully as my hand could set it down. I remember thinking, as the clean pages gathered, that the diary would outlive me. That is not a morbid thought at 70. It is a practical one. A man who has buried parents, a wife, children, friends, comrades, and neighbors does not suppose himself exempt from burial. Paper is frailer than flesh in one way and stronger in another. A body is laid down once. A page may be opened again. I did not know whose hands would open it. I knew that the act of binding was an act of trust. To bind pages is to say they belong together. To copy them is to say they are worth the labor. To hand them on is to say that the life recorded there need not perish when the voice that lived it is gone. If I had understood anything by 70, it was this. Memory is not owned by the one who carries it. It is held for a season. Then it must be given away, or it dies with him. The maps mattered to me. The obituary remembered them, and I am glad of that. A map is a different kind of testimony from a sentence. It shows how places lie in relation to one another, and how far a man has been carried from the field he once thought of as home. When I drew or preserved maps of the campaigns, I was not making art. I was trying to keep the shape of the road. The Red River country in memory was not only a name. It was water, timber, bad news, rumor, heat, disease, and the knowledge that armies can be confused while every man inside them must still obey. Bailey's Dam was not only an engineering feat to me. It was labor, axes, men straining at work that had to succeed because vessels and lives depended upon it. Spanish Fort and Fort Blakely were not only engagements near the end. They were earthworks, noise, waiting, and the knowledge that a war nearly finished could still kill a man before he saw home. As I copied, I sometimes found that the old page knew more than the old man. Memory had arranged events according to feeling. The diary arranged them according to sequence. That was humbling. A man may remember an incident vividly and place it too near another in his mind because both belong to the same inward chamber. The paper corrects him. It says, this day, then that day. This camp, then that march. This distance, then that landing. I accepted the correction. What the record does not say. There was a day in the copying when I came again to the morning at New Orleans, April 25th, 1864. I had written to Janet from the camp of distribution, expecting to start for the Red River. The old words were before me. Whatever I am doing, I think of home. I set the pen down. For a moment, the Iowa room was not gone, but another room stood inside it. I could feel the warmth of New Orleans, the uneasiness of men waiting to move, the Sabbath that had not felt like the Lord's Day. The thought of Janet not as an old woman beside me in the long peace, but as 24 years old at home with children and silence. I remembered the ache of not receiving letters and trying not to blame anyone for what war and distance had done. I remembered writing confidence while also placing myself in God's hand because confidence alone was not enough. An old man may be surprised by the tenderness of his younger self. I had not written that letter to be remembered. I had written because I loved my wife and children and did not know when I might write again. Then the Iowa room returned fully. Janet was no longer the young wife waiting in Wisconsin. She had crossed the years with me. The children of that letter had become men and women. The war had ended more than three decades before. Still, the sentence remained true. Whatever I was doing, even then at 70, my mind could wander home. When the clean copy was finished, the pages had to become something more durable than loose sheets. A daughter saw to the binding. The record does not allow me to say with certainty here all that I would like to say about that moment. But it records that one of my daughters had the rewritten diary professionally bound. That fact has remained, and it is enough to show that the work did not end at my desk. A bound book has a different authority in a household. Loose papers can be shifted, folded, tucked into drawers, lost between other things. A bound volume asks to be kept. Its cover says that the pages inside belong to one another. It says that a life, or at least one hard portion of a life, has been gathered. When I saw the diary bound, I did not think it made me important. It made me accountable. It meant that my children and those after them might someday see not only that I had served, but where I had gone and how I had counted the going. They might see that the war was made of particulars, not merely Union and Confederacy, victory and defeat, emancipation and surrender, but mornings, marches, names, prayers, rumors, sickness, courage, poor judgment, mercy, and longing. There is also a humility in binding such a thing, because a book is never wholly under the control of the man whose name may be attached to it. While papers remain in one's own keeping, he may decide when to open them and when to close them. He may explain himself to a child or choose not to speak. Once the papers are made into a volume, they begin to belong to a future in which the maker cannot answer questions. I knew that plainly enough. If a grandchild or a stranger someday found the pages and asked why a certain order was given, why a certain rumor was believed, why a certain march was made, I would not be standing beside him to correct his understanding. That knowledge did not keep me from binding the diary. It made the duty sharper. I had to trust the record to be itself. I had to trust that what I did not know in 1864 would appear as not knowing, and what I later understood would not be forced backward into the mind of a soldier who had not yet learned it. An old man can see the whole road in a way a soldier cannot. But if he writes too much of the whole road into the young soldier's mouth, he has stolen something from the truth. I had spent many years teaching children and keeping accounts. Both tasks had instructed me. A schoolmaster learns that a child must be led from what is known to what is not yet known. An assessor or bookkeeper learns that a wrong entry, however small it looks, may trouble the whole account. The diary asked both kinds of discipline from me. I wanted those who came after to be able to follow. I also wanted the entries to remain answerable to the days that produced them. By then, the 19th century was closing and the 20th had opened. I had been born in England before the first railroad had crossed much of the America I would later know. I had crossed the Atlantic as a young man and made my life in the United States. I had seen the Union nearly broken and preserved. I had lived to become an old Iowa man in a country that had remade itself faster than any one life could fully comprehend. Yet the center of my days was not the century, it was the ordinary rhythm the Lord gave me. Janet, children, grandchildren, church, work, accounts, neighbors, scripture, the weather, letters, visits, the body aging by degrees. The old stories asked for now and then. The graves visited when they could be. The paper read as comrades died and the ranks of the old soldiers thinned. After 1901, life did not become only remembrance. The living still had claims. We had children in different places, some near, some farther off. The family had grown beyond the noise of our own table into households of its own. By the time of my death, the number of descendants was large, children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. A man cannot hold all such lives in his daily hand, but he can hold them before God. The grandchildren altered old age in ways I had not expected. Children belong partly to discipline because they are under a parent's charge. Grandchildren belong more to wonder. They come into a room carrying the family forward without knowing they are doing it. In their faces, a man may see old features returned in new arrangements, an expression from one side, a turn of speech from another, a stubbornness or gentleness that seems to have traveled through blood and household example alike. They ask questions, and sometimes they do not ask the questions an old man is prepared to answer. They want to know whether there were alligators in the South, whether a gun was heavy, whether a horse was frightened, whether I was afraid. It is a serious thing to answer a child about fear. One must not lie, and one must not burden the child beyond his years. I learned to say less than memory contained. This was not secrecy. It was mercy in proportion. A family does not need every sorrow at once. The old soldier may carry more than he gives out in a single afternoon. Sometimes the better testimony is not the darkest story, but the habit of showing up at church, speaking truth, doing work, and letting the children know that a man may pass through violence without making violence his master. I served as I was able in the Baptist church and in Sunday school work into old age. The record remembers that I served as superintendent of Sunday schools into my 80s. I am grateful that such a thing was remembered. To teach children and to order lessons may seem small beside battles, but I do not think heaven counts it so. If war concerns what a nation is willing to defend, Sunday school concerns what a people is willing to teach its children after the defending is done. Sunday school also gave an old man a weekly answer to memory. The war had taught me how swiftly a life may be taken. The church taught again and again that a life must be formed before it is tested. Lessons had to be chosen. Teachers encouraged, attendants watched. Children who fidgeted on a bench had to be loved into attention without crushing the life out of them. Some would remember little of what was said, perhaps, but they might remember that Scripture was opened with care and that older people believed the soul of a child deserved labor. In my 80s, that work kept me among the living. Old age can draw a man inward until his own pains and recollections become his chief company. Service resists that. To be expected somewhere is a mercy. To have a task, even a smaller task than once before, is a kindness. The Lord did not leave me only with what had been. He gave me duties in what still was. In those later years, my body taught me limits. There is no shame in that, unless a man mistakes pride for strength. Eyes tire, hands slow. Hearing changes, steps shorten. A task once done quickly takes longer. A man who marched in the army must one day take care on stairs. If he is wise, he receives help without bitterness and gives thanks for what remains. Janet remained. That sentence carries more than I can say. She had been the wife of my war letters, the young woman who cared for the children while I served. She had been the mother in the crowded house, the keeper of duties no public record counted, the companion through Wisconsin, Waverly, Clarksville, Charles City, farms, children, deaths, marriages, church days, winters, and anniversaries. In November of 1921, we had been married 63 years. What the record does not preserve from Janet's late years. No letter from Janet at 80 is before me to quote. No diary page tells exactly what she said when the house had grown quiet and both of us knew we were nearer the end than the beginning. The record gives her dates, her Scottish birth, the eight-week voyage when she was a child, the children she raised, the husband she outlived, and the grave where she would be laid beside me. It does not give the sound of her step in the room. I imagine her in the late garden, not as a figure of sentiment, but as the woman she was, practical, watchful, accustomed to doing what the day required. If she walked beside me, she would have noticed whether the path was sound, whether the air was turning cold, whether I had done too much. If she read aloud when my eyes tired, she would have read plainly, not for display. If she sat near me in illness, she would not have needed many words. After more than 60 years, a husband and wife speak partly by habit and partly by silence. She knew the young soldier who had written to her from New Orleans. She knew the old man who had copied those soldier pages at a desk. She had not marched the miles, but she had borne their absence. Whatever record I left of the war, Janet's life was written into the cost of it. The world beyond our house continued to change. I had lived to see inventions and news that would have seemed strange to the young man from Fox Hill Bank. I had lived to see another great war come and go in Europe, a war fought across regions nearer the country of my birth than the bayous and rivers of Louisiana had been. Men younger than my grandchildren took up arms in a world changed in machinery, but not in the old sorrow of mothers, wives, and fathers waiting. I do not claim to have understood all the new age. Old men are sometimes tempted to judge too quickly what they did not build, but I knew enough to see that each generation is tested in its own way. The Civil War had been mine. The duty afterward had been to live as if preservation required more than victory. A Union can be saved on battlefields and neglected in households. It can be defended by armies and weakened by falsehood, selfishness, and forgetfulness. I believed then and believe now, as far as an old man's testimony may go, that truth and righteousness are not ornaments to a nation. They are necessities. My last home was at 402 Harwood Street in Charles City. A final address has a particular solemnity when others read it after a man's death. To the living, it is simply where the bed stands, where meals are taken, where visitors knock, where weather is watched from windows, where letters arrive, where prayers are said. Only afterward does it become final. In my last months, I was very old. 90 years is a long pilgrimage. I had outlived many who began before me and many who began after me. My first wife, Elizabeth Ellison, had been gone since 1857. Lou Eva had been gone since childhood. Fellow soldiers had been taken in war and afterward. Parents, siblings, in-laws, neighbors, comrades, and friends had passed beyond my reach. Janet was still with me, aged also, and that was a mercy beyond deserving. I cannot narrate my own death as if I stood outside it. I can only bring this account to its edge. On February 13th, 1922, in Charles City, Iowa, my earthly life ended at 90 years, 7 months, and 7 days. The record says I was buried at Linwood Cemetery in Clarksville, Butler County, the place that had held so many of our substantial years. The war had been 56 years behind me since discharge, yet it had not vanished. It remained in the diary, in the bound pages, in the mileage counted, in the letter to Janet, in the children and grandchildren who knew that the old man had once been a soldier, and in whatever Providence intended to preserve beyond our knowing. If there is any fitting close to my portion of this book, it is not that I died, all men do. It is that before I died, I tried to leave the road legible. I had been a child of Lancashire, a young immigrant, a Wisconsin farmer, a widower, Janet's husband, a father, a private soldier of the Union, an Iowa settler, a teacher, an assessor, a Sunday school superintendent, an old man with a pen, and finally a name cut into stone. The stone marks where the body rests. the paper marks where the voice waited. Edward Bennett died on February 13, 1922. Janet Hume Bennett, the woman he had written to from New Orleans in April of 1864, lived seven more years and died in 1929 in the same Charles City house at 402 Harwood Street. They are buried together in Linwood Cemetery at Clarksville, Iowa. The line that brought Edward's papers to me did not run through Janet by blood. It ran through Edward's first wife, Elizabeth Ellison, who died in Wisconsin in 1857, within days of giving birth to their daughter, Elizabeth Bennett. That daughter, Lizzie, was raised in Edward and Janet's household, grew up as sister to Janet's children, married Albon Briggs Shadbolt, and carried the Bennett line forward. Lizzie's daughter was Jessie Elizabeth Shadbolt Richards. Jessie's daughter was Marion May Richards Zwanziger. Marion's daughter was Donna Kathleen Zwanziger Weidelich. Donna's son is me. That is the chain by which a Civil War letter written to Janet in 1864 came into the hands of a boy in Iowa more than a century later. I did not understand the chain when I was 10. I only knew that my grandmother had boxes of old letters and a Union uniform, and that the uniform might have fit me. For most of my life, the letter remained partly closed. I carried photocopies, scans, fragments, and memory. I could see Edward's handwriting, but not fully enter it. Then in 2026, after more than 50 years of trying, I finally read what he had written. The words became clear. The man became present. He had sat in New Orleans thinking of home. He had hoped Janet was well. He had asked about children, in-laws, comrades, the war, the draft, the weather, the market greens, and the chance that letters might be waiting for him when he reached his regiment. He had put his trust in God and signed himself, "Your ever affectionate husband, Edward Bennett." At 70, Edward rewrote his diary because he wanted the road to remain legible. He could not have known me. He could not have imagined the tools by which I would one day read him, but he knew enough to preserve the record. The descendant came. The descendant read, and after all those miles, all those years, and all that silence, Edward Bennett's voice came home.
Edward Bennett died on February 13, 1922. Janet Hume Bennett, the woman he had written to from New Orleans in April of 1864, lived seven more years and died in 1929 in the same Charles City house at 402 Harwood Street. They are buried together in Linwood Cemetery at Clarksville, Iowa. The line that brought Edward's papers to me did not run through Janet by blood. It ran through Edward's first wife, Elizabeth Ellison, who died in Wisconsin in 1857 within days of giving birth to their daughter, Elizabeth Bennett. That daughter, Lizzie, was raised in Edward and Janet's household, grew up as sister to Janet's children, married Albon Briggs Shadbolt, and carried the Bennett line forward. Lizzie's daughter was Jessie Elizabeth Shadbolt Richards. Jessie's daughter was Marion May Richards Zwanziger. Marion's daughter was Donna Kathleen Zwanziger Weidelich. Donna's son is me. That is the chain by which a Civil War letter written to Janet in 1864 came into the hands of a boy in Iowa more than a century later. I did not understand the chain when I was 10. I only knew that my grandmother had boxes of old letters and a Union uniform, and that the uniform might have fit me. For most of my life, the letter remained partly closed. I carried photocopies, scans, fragments, and memory. I could see Edward's handwriting, but not fully enter it. Then, in 2026, after more than 50 years of trying, I finally read what he had written. The words became clear, the man became present, and he had sat in New Orleans thinking of home. He had hoped Janet was well. He had asked about children, in-laws, comrades, the war, the draft, the weather, the market greens, and the chance that letters might be waiting for him when he reached his regiment. He had put his trust in God and signed himself, "Your ever affectionate husband, Edward Bennett." At 70, Edward rewrote his diary because he wanted the road to remain legible. He could not have known me. He could not have imagined the tools by which I would one day read him. But he knew enough to preserve the record. The descendant came. The descendant read, and after all those miles, all those years, and all that silence, Edward Bennett's voice came home.